Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have the next episode in the mini series, and of course we have Millie Carr back. How are you, Millie?
I'm really good today. Thanks for having me back, Jane.
Well, I'm very excited. For anybody who hasn't been listening, do you want to do a quick 1-2 about who you are in case they haven't heard your introduction before?
Yeah, just really quickly, I'm a parent and teacher, so I've got both feet in both areas. I have got ADHD myself. My children, most three of them are diagnosed, and also have been working in education for 10 to 15 years. So I'm passionate about the area of disability inclusion and everything that I kind of work on to help students at school thrive and not struggle.
Great. So if you haven't listened to Millie's other episodes, it's all going to be in the show notes. What Millie really does well, and I think one of the reasons we get along so well, is we love talking about those internalized children, the masking girls or boys. So one of the things that gets so much traction whenever I post about it on Instagram or I talk about it on an episode is around why girls and high masking kids particularly are vulnerable to being dismissed by teachers as they're so great, there's nothing there, we can't see anything. So why do you think that happens?
As a teacher, Jane, those high masking individuals generally are fabulous students. So for teachers in the classroom, they are the ones that are sitting there, they are paying attention, they follow all the rules, they do all of these fabulous stuff at school. And for a teacher that isn't trained and doesn't know about masking, that isn't aware about autistic people, about ADHD, that doesn't have that training or background knowledge from having someone they know at home or themselves, it's very hard to sometimes pick it up because they're sitting there going, well, this student's thriving. They're going, wow, this student is completing their work to an absolutely fabulous standard. They are always lovely on the floor. They follow the rules. They do the right thing. And they are a joy and pleasure to have in the classroom for the teacher. And I guess the fact that we've got still biases around diagnosis for females and males, even though there are some males that are high masking as well, we do find that majority that are coming out later now are females. And the female representation and presentation for ADHD looks a little bit different. You're not going to see those high outbursts and big, big, big behaviors that you're normally seeing with students that aren't masking. So those things are really easy to pick up. Those things are really easy to see in the classroom and go, okay, there's something going on here. It's disrupting the classroom. It's changing the environment. It's making it not easy to just give out information in that kind of teaching style. Whereas when you've got a student that sits there, does the right thing, is looking relatively able to hide their emotions and hide what's actually going on internally, you're not really going to be able to pick that up. So until we have awareness of the different presentations of ADHD and autism in schools and in girls, boys, and we're going to see students continue to get missed because how can you pick up something that you're not aware of? How are you supposed to know what's going on? However, if a parent comes in and says something, well, then that's a different story. But if the parent's not saying anything and nor is the teacher at school, I can see why it could be quite really tricky because we have those continued biases that ADHD boys in the classroom jumping off the walls and disrupting everybody. It's not the girl sitting there doing her work to 110% standard and listening to all your instructions and not making a sound. They're not the ones that you're going to completely go to at the start, even though for someone like myself who knows this really, really well now, they're the ones that I highlight it quite quickly because I'm like, what's going on here? And I try and dig a little bit deeper to see if there's anything there because it's so strange that they're so obedient to the general rules in the classroom.
Oh, absolutely. I want to get into those biases next, but I have to share really quickly because I'm sure everyone's got a story like this. We wanted to build a house right near this great school that I thought it was going to be. And we had heaps of friends around there. And when my daughter hit grade 2, which is often with neurodivergent kids, it does get tricky. Prep seems to be more like, oh yeah, it's play-based. Or they're all young. It all seems to be fine. Grade 1 was okay. There was a lot of teacher emails about auditory processing. But in grade 2, we seemed to really hit this big issue. And one of the reasons we left that school was because my daughter was going through a really tricky time and she was really overwhelmed in the environment that she was in. And they put a big high needs class together, put her in that high needs class, even though she's high masking and the most model student ever. put her in that classroom with a split teacher that one of them was had maternity leave, she had postnatal depression, the other one was about to retire. They didn't have the skills, the commitment, whatever you need to manage that class, which was really tricky. And in the midst of this, she wasn't coping. And so I spoke to the school. We had diagnosed inclusion plans. And I said, I just want her to be able to go to the inclusion room at recess or lunch if she needs to take that break. And I would tell her to go there, but then she would be repeatedly dismissed by the teacher. They would tell her to go away and then come back and tell me that she didn't look like she needed to be there, and completely dismissing her regardless, because they said that she seemed okay. And that was one of the reasons we left the school, because they have absolutely no idea what they're talking about, and they couldn't get it through their head that she may be holding it together and she just wants to sit into a quiet room. So they would actually have a security guard let people in that were visibly having issues or visibly disabled, and then not let anybody else in because of the way that she looked and she politely asked. So with that, I'd love to know, what do you think those biases are, and how do you think that contributes to the we don't see it response?
Jane, I feel really sad for your daughter, because what constitutes looking like she's okay? What are they saying? How can they see inside her brain and see what's actually going on inside her brain?
Oh, and you know what? When I marched in there the next day and said to them, I promised her that she could go to that room, and she was turned away again, the vice principal of that school, who I have an absolute problem with, he said to me that she, as a grade two little girl, start of grade two, should stand up to the teacher and say, I'm allowed to be here, and then state what her issue is in front of a group. And I was like, hang on a second here. How is it up to her to advocate for herself? Why do you not just have a photo of her up or tell the person who's on? Like, it's a small school. What's the problem? And he put it back on her and told me that she needs to work on her confidence.
Firstly, she's in grade two. She probably has a whole lot of anxiety around being at school and the dresses that she was going under anyway, let alone having to then, in grade two, advocate. It's hard for adults to advocate for themselves.
And then he says to tell her, to tell them that they're wrong. And I'm like, hang on a second. Is it not your responsibility to communicate with your teachers? It's a small primary school. Mm-hmm. Why is it up to her to communicate your plan that you came up with?
It's a perfect story to relate to this, because the bias is there. Unless you can see it, it doesn't exist. And then also the females often get turned away, but also as adults for so many medical things, we just get pushed away and not acknowledged for our experience. But the visible versus invisible disabilities is very hard for some people to get across in their brain, that not everyone is visibly showing what's going on inside, but doesn't mean that it's any less real. And then they're still being dismissive. And that just is evidence of a school that did not have enough education, compassion, and empathy for your daughter. I've had parents contact me about how to go into IEP meetings and what to do in these kind of situations when the school just isn't listening to what you're saying and have these biases there going on. The leadership team need to really lead this and filter it down. If the leadership team are aware of these things and have education, they're going to put forward professional development for teachers to teach them about these things and how to spot a student that might be invisibly struggling underneath. I feel like those biases are the things that we need to educate about first before we can even move on to anything else. If we still have these biases there and teachers are automatically going, she doesn't need to have any adjustments and they don't need to have those supports because I can't see it happening, that just shows that the education is just not there, and we need to start educating and spreading the word about. And I think it just really depends sometimes on the person and the people that you get in the environment that you're in. You might be lucky to have a school in your postcode that actually is really neurodiversity affirming, but then 30 minutes down the road, you're going to have a school that's completely different. So there needs to be something out that mandates an awareness and education for all teachers and leaders about these things, so that they are aware and that they're not going to be coming to you with those biases like, oh, I don't think she needed it because I couldn't see it. I'm hoping they wouldn't say that if they were aware and knew about how the students are feeling underneath.
Okay, so let's use the example with my daughter. So I'm receiving back from the school that she seems completely fine, and what I'm seeing at home is absolutely not fine. And then I'm going to the school with facts, kilos of weight being lost, pediatrician letters, psychologist letters, GP letters, OT letters. So I go back armed with evidence because I'm not going to back down. And it's difficult to know when you're in that situation what you can actually practically do. In the end, my husband pulled me aside and said, because we run our own business, and he said, look at the amount of money that we're losing by you being consumed with this fight. Yeah. We are banging our head against a wall. These people don't get it. And so we ended up deciding that we had to leave. But not every parent is in that position. And sometimes you've got to keep going. What are some things that parents can do practically if a school is saying that a child seems fine?
So the first thing that I always tell parents when I'm talking to them about advice for this kind of thing is to make sure that everything is in writing. If they reject a reasonable adjustment that you've asked for, get that in writing. Make sure that you have notes on every meeting that you have. If you need to, bring someone with you for your meetings so that you've got some support. Sometimes parents come in really emotional, which is completely understandable because it's their child. This is their life. And you sometimes forget when you're in that state what you want to say and how you want it to come across. And schools can sometimes get defensive to that emotion. So make sure that you've prepared what you want to say. You've got it all written down. You've got some speaking notes. You have maybe a support person. Don't go in with all of the kids all at once either. Get some babysitters for other children that you've got. Go in there to your meetings and make sure you've got everything in writing so that you've got evidence of what they've said, how they reacted. If you're starting with just the teacher first, then you can obviously move up to leadership. They're the first kind of points of call. Hopefully leadership generally will be a little bit more like understanding and be able to help you with that. If they're still resisting, then you need to start going further and go to a regional kind of area and make a complaint to your regional education area. And then you can also go to the Department of Education and write a letter and kind of complain about what's happening, because what you're talking about, Jane, they're not actually following federal law. It is federal law to make reasonable adjustments. They have to make a very strong case that it is not reasonable. And most of the time, the things that you were asking just then about going to that the special sensory kind of room, that's a very reasonable adjustment. Unless you're asking for everyone to be outside of the classroom and just your student by themselves, like that's an unreasonable adjustment. But reasonable adjustments are federal law and they come under the Disability Discrimination Act and also the Disability for Education Act as well. So you can actually go and take all of those complaints forward and go to the Department of Education. So you can go to the Human Rights Commission as well. If you were wanting to continue with that particular school and really advocate, and you've got the money and time to put into that, that's the progression of where you would go. Or like you said, sometimes it's trying to find a different avenue of education for your student. And some things are not very viable for parents at home. Homeschooling, we're seeing that really skyrocket at the moment, people taking their kids out and homeschooling. I've taken my daughter out. She's in year 11 this year. She is now with Virtual Schools Victoria. That's a Victorian-based homeschool program that you can go to. So there's also those kind of options you can look into. But if that's not viable for you, then those are the kind of steps. And make sure, I'd be telling you to make sure you keep documentation of absolutely every conversation, everything that's said, everything that they refused, and have some support with you when you go so that you don't feel railroaded. Make sure you do some research before to figure out what is within your legal scope and reasonable adjustments within the scope that the school should provide under federal law. And then you can take those steps a little bit further.
I agree. I think that's great. The only thing that I was going to add was I found with that particular school, not that there was a battle to really win, but I've let them fall on their own sword, let's say, because they continue on with the same crap. But what I did found worked was I got an outcome where I knew it wasn't going to work and it forced a decision where I would email this particular vice principal after the meeting with the date and say, I spoke to you. I provide you with these letters. Here's the scanned copy. This is what I asked for. You said on Thursday that you would do this. And then I would follow up with them on the Thursday. Did you do that? Which they never did. And they would not respond to anything I had written, but I would write in writing what they said they would do, what I asked for, and what I provided them. And I think that really drew the line in the sand in terms of I'm not going to take shit from you people because I didn't trust that they were going to do anything that was asked. But I find that sometimes after a verbal meeting, especially a couple of months ago, it's like, but you said you were going to do that last month, but no one can really remember it. And if you think you're going to end up in a proper argument, it's really good to take those notes, but put them in writing and email it, not just put it in your phone. Yep. Would you agree with that?
As a protocol for where I work, that's something that we do as a school anyway. So you can ask them to do it if you don't want to actually be the one that writes. So they should be taking notes in like an SSG meeting or in an IEP meeting. They should be taking notes. And in that afterwards, I always email off the IEP and I go, okay, this is what we discussed. These are our notes from the meeting. These are the actions. If anyone has any actions to follow, whether it be the school or yourself as a parent. So you need to have a check-in time too. So it doesn't just get lost, like you said, Jane, weeks down the track and then nothing's happened. It's like, okay, in 2 weeks, we're going to check back in, either a phone call or an email about this action and see what's going on and how it's improved or not improved or what kind of difference it's made. So that's something that I think schools should be doing. Schools should be letting you know what the conversation was with the notes, with the minutes. You can say, can you please email me the minutes of the meeting and the actions after this, please?
And that, I think, really helped me figure out whether I was being, air quoting, unreasonable, or whether there was an issue with the school, because you start to question yourself when they then tell you it's your fault because you've got the problem. And you're starting thinking, well, hang on a second, maybe I am being unreasonable. But when you record all the conversations, you get no response, you get no outcome, you get no action. It starts to paint a picture of like, these people in this leadership team are never going to be where I need them to be. And that made the decision easier when I actually had that all written and I went, right, got a best friend over. Let me show you what I've got back. Can you just tell me, am I being too much? And yeah, it was a response of, I think you should leave that school.
You did the right thing, Jay. And I feel like the evidence was really clear that was not going to improve for you. And it's really upsetting to hear that there are schools and so many schools across Australia that are like that, because there are so many that are not. And it should not be the case that some students get treated like that and other students get all the adjustments and all the accommodations and are included and it's fabulous. And then you've got other schools where you've got a fight, and parents shouldn't have to fight like that just to have their student feel like they belong and feel safe at school.
It's Oh, totally. When you have your school tour or whatever it is, they should just say outright, this is our policy with inclusion. We don't respond. And unless your child's got some visible need, we don't really want to know. Look, I just prefer, tell me that up front. Don't tell me about your inclusion plan that you've got written down that no one understands. But anyway, that is another whole picking a school topic.
Would we be able to talk about
the difference between anxiety and the difference between an unmet neurodivergent need, because they get confused?
Anxiety is always one that is pinpointed first a lot of the time for students and adults, especially females. This is not always the case, but a lot of the time it is females that are told that they are anxious. Maybe they're going home with sore tummies or things like that from school. And anxiety is where you're fearful of something happening, and it's not something that lasts forever. Whereas anxiety as a result of an unmet need for neurodivergent people is more about their unmet needs in terms of social needs, sensory needs, academic needs. They're in a world that isn't set up for them. The anxiety wouldn't be there if they were in an environment that was set up from the start to cater to their needs, which it's not. The world is set up in a neurotypical kind of way that expects neurotypical norms, and the anxiety from, you know, communicating and socializing in a way that is neurotypical can cause so much anxiety, especially for young girls at school. I know my daughter had very similar issues with that. That caused her the most of her anxiety about school was the social aspect of it and the social rules that she wasn't picking up and she wasn't kind of doing. That's how I differentiate them. And it's important to differentiate them too and look deeper. If you're just going to say anxiety and treat anxiety, give someone some breathing techniques and things like that, that's not actually going to resolve the deeper issue if you don't tackle and talk about neurodivergence as well and those kind of unmet needs.
Oh, I totally agree. I was having a bit of a think about the other day, is mental health like back pain? Because really, when you have back pain as a child, I believe that medically that's usually investigated. They want to do possibly an x-ray. They look at podiatry. They look at why scoliosis. Is there an issue? Has there been a trauma? Why is there back pain? We don't just treat back pain like here's a massage, here's an adjustment. There's an investigation as to why it's there, because it's happening so young, right? Okay, so why with anxiety and depression do we not investigate properly? If anxiety is just like back pain, we don't just give ibuprofen indefinitely and say it's treatment-resistant anxiety. There is some kind of investigation as to why it's there. Yeah. If you have a person with back pain and they're in their 60s and they've been a builder for their whole life, well, there probably is going to be back pain. But if you've got a kid who's six, why are we just letting anxiety be just a symptom? Here's some breathing techniques. Here's an SSRI. It's like, yeah, but why is it there?
And we need to dig deeper.
Completely agree. Yeah. And one more last question. This is going to be a big one though for the episode, Millie. Why is PDA, which is pathological demand avoidance? I do have an episode on it. I'll put that in the show notes for anybody who wants to hear more just about that. But if we talk about this in the classroom, why is it so misunderstood or missed in the classroom?
So many people still don't actually know what it is, if I'm being honest with you. It's something that is so completely misunderstood and only something that's starting to get a bit of a voice in the last year or so. I feel like 5 years ago, it's something that no one at school would have heard at all. And a lot of students with PDA, a PDA profile, were diagnosed in the past with things like oppositional defiance disorder, where we know that PDA is actually a nervous system response to the lack of autonomy. And how much in a school environment do you have a lack of autonomy? A lot of the time, you're not given a choice of where to sit, what to do, how to start your task, all of those things. And especially with girls, a lot of the girls that kind of have a PDA profile come out really bossy, controlling. They seem like they're being manipulative. So the same way people have that bias and that stereotype about boys with ADHD, right, jumping off the walls, girls that are manipulative, they're saying they're manipulative or they're arguing back or they're resisting those kind of demands. We find that they're the ones, we're just labeling them as just being like, again, like boys with ADHD, naughty, they're defiant, they're rude, they don't share with the group, they're not great with the kids because they boss them around. And we don't look any deeper than that because we go, oh, they're just a bossy kind of kid, where it's a really deep-rooted nervous system kind of issue that they, and there's so much lack of autonomy at school and there's so many demands placed on them at school that it comes out very obviously them resisting things or arguing back, being defensive, refusing to do tasks. And a little bit of a thing, and you might have had it in your previous episode, Jane, and this is something that teachers can do just in general, is changing the way we speak from saying things in a way where we ask lots of questions. Questions trigger PDA, nervous system is going crazy, rather than saying, can you start your task now? It could be like, we're going to start our task now, this one or this one. So rather than asking them to start the task, we're saying, we're starting the task now. You can start it with the blue pencil or the red pencil. And often that kind of takes away some of that stress. That's a little tip that kind of I found by changing all of my language to that for everybody, even the ones that I wasn't aware had PDA, mitigate some of those really big kind of reactions sometimes to demands in the classroom. So if you don't know about it though, and you're not aware of how you're speaking, you're asking a million questions a day, you're just setting off these kids left and center in the classroom. So some little easy little trick, but that's the reason why they're getting this. It's just so it's unknown still to a lot of teachers what this is.
I think we should do a whole episode on PDA because I'm fascinated, to be honest.
It's so crazy, isn't it?
Stay tuned. I think we're going to do another whole episode on PDA because I've just got 17 questions from that you've spoken about. Then I think we're going to get Millie back in for the PDA episode just purely because I want to know. So that is it for today, even though I feel like we could have talked forever. Thank you so much for your time, Millie. We will catch you next week for the next episode of the mini series. Thank you so much.
Excellent. No worries. Thanks, Jane. See ya.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD month shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.